Hello, I'm Neil Bernstein. I'm the Research and Development Officer at NLS. It's nice to see most of you again, and nice to meet those of you I haven't met yet. One of the problems with being the last person from NLS to speak is that you've heard a lot of this stuff already, it turns out. I didn't quite realize you would, but so please forgive any repetition. I also didn't realize I'm supposed to come up here with a groaner joke. So I made one up while I was sitting there. What pop group best represents NLS in 2017? 21 Pilots. Cause, thank you. I'll be here for the next 45 minutes, yes. Okay. Lots to talk about, all kinds of things. We'll go through them. I'm trying to give you an update on all the technical work that NLS is doing. And we'll start with our old friend, Bard. Bard is 10. Did you guys realize that? Yeah. Well, it depends on how you count. The original Bard pilot was in October of 2006, which makes Bard 10 years old. We had what's called the expanded download. That was in September of 2007. That's when we sort of let anybody who had a third-party player sign up. So we're somewhere between our 10th birthday and our 10th birthday, depending on how you count. But there's not much to tell you that's new with Bard, the website, per se. Really two pieces of news, one much bigger than the other. The first is that we do plan to add the ability to subscribe to book series to Bard, just like you can subscribe to a magazine now. So you'll go find the series page and punch a button that says subscribe me to this series. At that time, you can choose to have everything in the series added to your wish list right then and there, or you can choose to just have new items as they come in be added to your wish list with a friendly email telling you there was something new added. We know how much folks love their series, so we'll be looking forward to putting that into place. The other piece of news about Bard is we're blowing the whole thing up, but I'll talk a lot more about that later. It's just minor news, don't worry. Don't worry, it'll still be Bard. Okay, but sticking with the Bard theme, Bard Mobile iOS. There hasn't been a new version for a while, but I am happy to say that we are working on it. Last fall, we signed a new contract for maintenance of the Bard Mobile iOS product, and the folks who won that contract were the same folks who had the contract before, and that's Shinano Kenshi Corporation of Japan. That's really good news. They've done a beautiful job on the application, and they're continuing to work on it. So version 1.2, we hope, will be out by the end of summer. It's going to add, first of all, complete iOS 10 compatibility. Now that iOS 11 is coming out a month later, we'll be behind the curve again, but for now we're trying to get updated to iOS 10. We're going to be adding some other features. One of them is called dynamic type. So for those of you who are familiar with iOS, there's a system-wide setting where you can say how big fonts and things like that are supposed to be. We had that built into the application itself, but we're removing that from the app, and we're going to build that the app such that it will respect whatever the system setting is. So now if you need larger print on your iPhone, you can set that in one place in the system settings, and Bard Mobile will come along with that. We're doing something interesting with Braille. We're going to try to successfully auto-reflow Braille books. The BRF format that we use is a rigid 40 cells per line, but that doesn't always make for a comfortable reading experience when you are reading on a Braille display that is shorter than that. So we're going to build in software that will take those lines of text and make optimize basically for the size of the Braille display that you're using. So if you're using a 32 cell display, we'll get as many words as possible on that line before making you pan over to the next line. We're going to add previous downloads, most popular books, and browsing magazines as top level menu items. We're going to make the total reading time more visible. We're going to try to clean up the error messages. I know those are a real pain point for folks when Bard is having any kind of problem. You get repeated error messages, so we'll try to do a better job with that. We're going to have it automatically load the next 50 items when you're scrolling through the list of recently added or any of the others. We're going to add a patron favorite, a beep-free mode, so it's not constantly beeping and squawking at you. A lot of people wanted to see that happen. A bunch of other small additions as well. And in addition to Bard Mobile iOS, we're going to be, it doesn't look like this, we are going to be working on Bard Mobile for Android as well. We also have a new contractor for that. Forgive me, I'm having a little trouble advancing here. I have no control. Hey, there it is, Bard Mobile Android. Okay, so another version of that is coming as well, and it is going to have many of the same new features that Bard Mobile for iOS is getting. We've also got an experimental feature that's going to go into Bard Mobile for Android. We're not quite sure when yet, but I want to tell you about it because it's kind of exciting. Michael Katzman, who is the chief of our materials development division and official in-house mad scientist, has come up with a way to simulate streaming for the Bard mobile apps. And the idea would be that when you go to read a book, instead of having to wait for the whole thing to download, it actually could download the early pieces of the book and then immediately begin to play back the very beginning of the book while it is either continuing to download the rest or giving you the option to say, I don't want to read this book anymore. So we're going to start that on the Android side because we have a little more control over that version of the application. And then if that is successful, we can move that into the iOS app as well. Bard Express. I hope you're all familiar with Bard Express by now. Bard Express was released last December. It's a piece of Windows software that helps people out with the selection and download and unzipping and transferring process. And we're working on a new version of Bard Express as well. The things we are going to add, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble accessing my notes. Well, before we get into the Bard API, I'll have to wing it. The things we're going to add to Bard Express include certainly some bug fixes. We're going to try to put in a sort of a public kiosk mode so that users, libraries can put Bard Express in a place where multiple people could make use of the same installation of Bard Express. One of the problems now is you log into Bard Express and you stay logged into Bard Express and you have no choice. There's no way to log out. So you have to, you can't get multiple users on that particular installation. So we're going to fix that so that there'll be a way to log out, or we can have it even automatically time out after a certain amount of time. The next thing was Bard API, and there's not been a whole lot of action on the Bard API. The Bard API is, as Richard told us earlier, the application programming interface. The Bard API is how the Bard mobile applications talk to Bard. And of course, we opened that up to third parties a few years back, and you saw there some of the devices that make use of the Bard API. And we still have additional partners coming. We've got a new product from Dolphin that I'll be able to show you tomorrow over in the hands-on session at 3:15 called the Guide Reader Pod. This is a really interesting little device because it actually hooks up to a television and allows you to read Bard books using your TV and a remote control. It's kind of funky, different from what other folks have been doing. And we had interest from a company called Blind Shell. They're actually in the Czech Republic, and they make an Android phone that is geared toward blind users, and they want to introduce Bard playback as well. So some new things coming on the Bard API side. All right, let's talk about a few other things. Synthetic speech, I think we covered pretty well. Or in earlier presentations, but as I said, there was a disadvantage to being the last person to talk because, you know, stuff's been covered. Well, there is also an advantage. I have more up-to-date information. So Steve was talking about some problems we had making the actual books that we're going to be using in our synthetic speech pilot. It turns out we have overcome those difficulties. The computers have been chugging away, and we have now made about 70 books using synthetic speech voices. For those of you who keep track, from Ivona, we're using the Kendra, the Joey, and the Sally voice. A little more detail on that pilot. I want to reiterate that. I'm sorry? The goal, of course, of using text-to-speech is not replacing our human narrators. Of course, it's increasing availability. The tool that we're using to make the books converts books from EPUB to DTB, and that's because, as Karen has said, we now have access to a wealth of EPUB books, e-text books that we can then feed to this tool to have it create our DTBs for us. The books that we're using for the pilot were chosen by an NLS selection librarian. They're books that are meant to be either very topical, in other words, we wanted to be able to get them out quickly, or the sort of long tail books that would not otherwise have been a part of the NLS program. There are four libraries that are going to help us out with this pilot. They're Tennessee, Pittsburgh, Ohio, and Washington. And the real interesting thing, I think, is to find out how folks who are not normally exposed to text-to-speech react to getting text-to-speech. I mean, there's plenty of folks out there who have been reading books that way for quite some time. That's not really... they have their opinions, and we're not going to sway them with these books that we're making, but there's also plenty of folks who have not been exposed to text-to-speech, to synthetic speech, and we really want to know what they have to say about it. I also just found out that it turns out that there are books on BARD already that have a little bit of synthetic speech in them. And the fact that nobody has pointed that out is telling, because they may not even realize they're listening to synthetic voices. They come from one of the regional libraries. Anybody in the room want to fess up? Perkins. 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 No, it's not the entire book. They just used, What was the voice that you used, Kim? Do you know?
Well, I don't remember.
Okay.
But it was a female voice, and she's really good. So I'll find out and let you know.
Anyway, it is just a starting point. The books that we're making, we have deliberately decided to just let the tool run with them. We are not putting them through quality assurance. We're sort of using a lowest common denominator book, and we're going to see what people have to say and figure out what it is precisely they don't like about them. If people are talking about the voice or people talking about the accuracy of the markup or that sort of thing. So we're looking to survey these people after each book. We'll have a telephone survey that they can call, and we'll give them a call at the end of the pilot to get sort of final impressions from everybody. And I guess we'll report back to you in Tennessee in the spring and let you know what we got out of that. TBMNG, that's Talking Book Machine, Next Generation. we don't know what we're calling this thing yet. There's been some people around the office who say, don't call it the Digital Talking Book Machine. Of course it's digital. Everything's digital. So we've dropped the D for now. That's us being progressive, right? This is good. There are some things we know about it, right? We know that it will be an internet-connected player. We know that you will be able to push a book to a patron's machine instantly. There are certain basics that we have established. We're also, at this point, working with some consultants to, and I think and Karen alluded to this earlier, come up with a set of what we call guiding principles, real sort of high-level characteristics of the machine. For example, we've said the machine will do everything that the previous machine was able to do. We've said that the machine will be discoverable, intuitive, and easy to use. We're looking at the bookshelf feature there. Yes, we don't want to have any features that are so difficult to use that they're not being used. But beyond that, we haven't established a whole lot about the machine. So we are just in the process of getting these initial requirements done. You heard about the pedometer one. That one was, you know, something that was suggested. Probably not going to happen. But there's a question.
I was just wondering, do you think it'll be smaller in size than the present machine?
I expect it will be smaller, not pedometer small. But don't forget that one of the most wonderful characteristics about the current machine is the sound quality. And we definitely do not want to take a step backward in either sound quality or battery life. Battery technology has improved, but there will be other demands on the battery, mostly the Wi-Fi that's going to be in there. So there'll be It'll be interesting to see. I do expect it'll be a little smaller. Harry, can I get a little bit of help up here? Because I'm unable to get to my own notes. This is very difficult. So maybe one of the mats can help out. Sorry about this, folks. I can't move my mouse because it advances the... So I can't scroll down in my notes here.
Gotcha. Oh, you know using how, the mouse at all?
I'm just using it to advance my slides, so...
Sorry, I'm just... Where is the mouse?
Exactly.
Well, maybe it's over on that
okay,
screen.
Okay, there we go.
There it is.
People are watching the live stream, and they're not able to hear questions. So we're trying to get to you with a microphone, and we're just going to ask that you please wait until we have a mic for you so that everybody's able to hear everything that's being communicated. That will really help us out. Are we ready?
I think we're good. Great. Sorry about that. All right, two things in terms of activity that I want to tell you about. One is that we are, as a part of getting ready to develop the next generation, the TBMNG, I've got to call it the right thing, is we're going to have a software player developed for us. So we want to test out user interface concepts. What should the buttons look like? How should things react? And the easiest way to do that is to actually build the whole thing as an application that would run on a desktop computer and then take the physical interface and build that separately as a set of buttons. So the idea is that would then talk to the computer, and we can, through software, completely simulate the way that the final device would work. So we have an interagency agreement with the USDA, of all people. They actually have a software development arm, and they are working on this software player for us. Right now they're working on the very basic stuff, you know, DTB playback and that sort of thing. But when we are ready to start testing out some of the interface concepts, that's what we're going to be able to use to try different things. And what's nice about that is you can try them on the fly. Back when we were testing the current digital talking book machine, we had to bring prototypes to libraries, and if there was something that we wanted to try as an alternate concept, we couldn't really do that. We couldn't change the software right then and there, but this will allow us to do that. That's going to be very useful. The other interesting thing that's going on is we are not 100% decided, but leaning toward including a voice-driven interface in this device. Now, this is an area that is changing very rapidly. Google, for themselves, just announced last month that the current error rate, in other words, the rate at which they correctly understand words that people are saying to their devices, is below 5% now. So they understand 95% of what you say. Now, incidentally, that's also the rate for humans listening to you speak. Humans will also get about 95% of what you say correctly. So they've actually reached the point where they can understand your speech as well as a human can. Now, that's Google, and they have giant server farms and all these other things to accomplish that. But as we know, technology like this doesn't stay still, and it's quite possible that we're going to be able to put a reasonable voice-driven interface into a device that sits in your home. Of course, people already have those, right? Everyone's familiar with Alexa and Google Home, and Apple now has a HomePod that's coming out at the end of the year that can do this with Siri in it. And we've been actually playing with that a little bit ourselves. I brought an Alexa, Amazon Echo unit with me that I'll also have at tomorrow's session at 3:15 that can talk to Bard, listen to commands from you to ask it to search Bard for different books and tell you about that. So that's something we're working on back at home in Washington also. In fact, we have a summer intern who is a college student who's actually going to work with us on building that out. We have also talked to the DAISY Consortium and Google about possibly bringing this to the Google Home device. DAISY is interested because all the libraries for the blind around the world are running into the same problem. They are getting demands from users to be able to read books through these devices in their homes. So DAISY is working with other libraries, and they want to have sort of a unified way of going about implementing this. So NLS wouldn't be the only library participating in that. We'd be working with others to try and figure out the best way to bring talking books to your Google Home device or your Google Assistant. Okay. It says in my notes here right now I'm supposed to give you the mic speech. Let me tell you what that is. So Mike Mardies was also invited to participate in this conference, and he sends his apologies that he was not able to attend, because he is, as he is fond of saying, up to his ass in alligators. That's his favorite expression. It wouldn't be a conversation with Mike Mardies without a good homie metaphor. And so I went to talk to him, and I said, what do you want me to tell people at the Northern Midlands Conference? And he said, tell them the sky is falling. Tell them the end is near. And I said, Mike, I know you're not a big fan of the Trump administration, but I don't want to get political, and I don't think that, you know, that's a bit alarmist, isn't it? And he said, no. He said, tell them the sea levels are rising, and they've got to start thinking about how they're going to sell their beachfront property. Okay. He said, tell them all the cars are going electric, and they have to stop hiring gas station attendants, because it's just not going to help them. Mike, what are you talking about? He said, well, we have this shelfless future coming. Okay, this is what he's concerned with, right? He is concerned that we are going to do all this work and move toward this wireless delivery where you are pushing books directly out of the cloud down onto folks' players. But he wants to make sure that you guys are ready for that when it happens. Now, Karen has said that that's 5 years out, and Karen has said you will have options, but he does want to make sure that when you have figured out what option you plan to choose, how you're going to approach the shelfless future, that you work with us at NLS and that you work specifically with your circulation system vendors to make it known how it is you'd like to see this all come about. So, yes, a bit alarmist, but Mike's job is to prepare for the future, and the message he really wants to send you guys is to start thinking very seriously about this. I defended you guys. I said, these are brilliant people. They're forward-looking. They're all generally very attractive, and they shouldn't have any problem with this. But, you know, we're going to make sure that the you get where you need to be. I've lost my mouse cursor again. There it is. All right. Next subject. Braille. Let's talk a little bit more about Braille. Yes, that says Braille. You should be able to read that. If you can't, at least go learn those three letters. Okay. We're working on Braille on two fronts. And again, Karen alluded to a lot of this in her earlier comments. One of them actually that she didn't talk about was that we are coming up with a new format for Braille books. We've been using BRF for a long time for our electronic Braille. BRF is a rigidly formatted file format, and it is essentially intended for embossing, right? So it's exactly 40 characters across and 25 lines down, and it's got embedded page numbers. And when you go to read that in an electronic version, it's kind of annoying. It has that rigid formatting, and things get interrupted as you're reading, and there's blank spaces and all that. And we've done the best we can to try to mitigate that in the Bard mobile application, which does allow you to read BRF files, and it does things like skip blank space and that sort of thing. But really, it's not a whole lot better for reading than a text file would be if you were reading electronic text. And that's to say that there's no navigability, okay? There's no metadata that's carried in the file. We have to deal with multiple volumes. All these things are deficiencies of the BRF format, and we are looking to replace the BRF format. So we've got a group together that is coming up with the specifications for a new Braille format. Maybe I should call that BRFNG, I don't know. But it's going to be based on the EPUB 3 standard, which means it will have all of the things I just mentioned, and it will really bring it up on par with the digital talking book in terms of the things you can do with it. So now, if you're reading a Braille book and you want to jump to the next chapter, you should be able to tell your reader, take me to the beginning of the next chapter. You can't do that with the BRF file. You will be able to do that with our new file format. The other thing is that instead of a zip file, EPUB keeps everything into one single file, so when you're manipulating Braille books electronically, you're only dealing with one file for the entire book. That'll be nice for people, too. Once we've got that format in place, we're actually going to test it with users. We're going to create essentially a Braille format tester, and that will be the combination of a Raspberry Pi. You guys know what a Raspberry Pi is? It's not edible. It's a small single-board computer. Raspberry Pi can have Bluetooth, and it will drive a Bluetooth Braille display. So we'll be able to take books that are in this new format, put them in front of patrons, let them try it out, see how they like, how things are presented, how things are navigated. So it's really sort of an analog to that software player that I was telling you about earlier for the talking book machine. So that's coming, that's down the road, and that's work that we're doing with the USDA as well. And as Karen has mentioned, and others have mentioned, we've gotten our legislation change. We are starting to look at the new e-reader, Braille e-reader, that we want to provide from NLS, much in the same way that we provide the digital talking book machines. Karen mentioned a pilot test that we're doing with Perkins that is making use of the Orbit Reader 20. For those of you who haven't heard of that, it's a brand new and low-cost Braille e-reader. It doesn't use piezoelectronic technology. It uses a different way to drive the pins that make the Braille. The manufacturer won't say what that is, So it's really kind of a curious technology. Eventually, I really want to tear one apart and see what's in there, but they are very hard to come by right now. We hope by Kim this summer.
We hope so.
We hope so, that we will have taken, that Perkins will have taken delivery. Yes. And again, we'll have one in the hands-on area tomorrow. Perkins will have taken delivery of a couple hundred of those and gotten them out to patrons. And again, sort of like the text-to-speech pilot, we're going to be doing another pilot. We're going to be surveying the patrons. We're, again, interested in the folks who haven't been exposed to electronic Braille before to see how they accept it, essentially. And eventually, then, of course, NLS is going to start working on its own reader. And being a government body, we are going to be going out for a request for proposals, so we will not necessarily be distributing the Orbit Reader 20, but we are using it for the pilot. We'll have free and open competition for the final product. We expect that the final product will be something similar to what's on the market right now. Nothing on the market right now exactly meets all the requirements that we have, but they're all pretty close, and I think it's going to be easy for some manufacturer to adapt a product that they've got to our requirements. Before we do that RFP, we're doing an RFI, a request for information. We're essentially putting out there our first cut at the requirements and saying, this is what we kind of want. Are we crazy? Can you deliver this? How much would it cost, roughly? That sort of thing. That actually went down to the Library of Congress Contracting Office, should be today or tomorrow, so that's really imminent. So by July, we should be getting responses back from manufacturers to find out if folks are really going to be able to manufacture this thing at a reasonable cost, given the requirements that we're giving them. But we do expect it'll be a standalone reader, that it will have Wi-Fi, that will have 20 cells. That's almost the only thing that we've absolutely determined at this point. Although, actually, we're curious about 40 cells, too, and what it would cost, but that's unlikely. So, I'm sorry, did I say Wi-Fi? Yes, I mean Bluetooth, yes. We want it to be able to read books that are loaded into its memory, either transferred to it or brought in off of a cartridge. And we want it to also function as a client for a phone or a computer so that you can use it with a screen reader on your PC or your Mac, or you can use it with BrailleBack on Android or VoiceOver on iOS. So those are the basic requirements we have for it. Thinking down the road, we want it also to be able to interface nicely with the talking book machine so that when that machine is in your house and it is giving you the ability to go to the cloud and select books from NLS, you'll be able to select either audiobooks that you'll be able to read right on that machine or Braille books that you'll be able to bring down and transfer through Bluetooth to this reader. So we're going to make sure it's got Bluetooth in it so that when the day comes, we'll be able to make that kind of transfer. All right. What comes after Braille? MVNE. Okay, I was going to quiz you guys and ask you who remembered from this morning what MVNE stood for, but Richard gave it away. Does anyone actually remember? Mobile Virtual Network Enabler. I don't know about that enabler word. That used to be a positive thing to say. You guys probably know what an MVNO is, even though you've never heard, if you've never heard that term. MVNO is a mobile virtual network operator. These are folks like Cricket Wireless and Boost Mobile. These are phone companies that offer cell service or cellular data service who don't actually own any infrastructure. Okay, an MVNE is one step removed from that. They're the folks who help MVNOs do what they do. So they do a lot of the sort of administrative side, the billing and that sort of thing. And we are working with this company, Artera, who is an MVNE, and they are helping us out with a test that we're doing. Now, why are we doing this? Yes, we're looking to the wireless future. And in order to do that, we need to know what the feasibility of distributing books wirelessly is. Now, the talking book machine will have Wi-Fi, but not everybody has Wi-Fi in their home. Okay, so we are counting on the cellular network to be a fallback. All right, so if you don't have Wi-Fi at home, we would issue you a talking book machine and a bridge to go from the cellular network to Wi-Fi that you could only use to get books through, to communicate with the NLS servers. So how do we test this? Well, the panel earlier talked about a device called Mocha. Mocha is this guy. Here's a picture of my Mocha. Let me describe it. It's a black project box. It's about the size of a don't know, what would you say, like a meatloaf pan. It's 9 by 3 by 4, something like that. It's got a speaker in the top. You may recognize the speaker. It's the same one that's in the talking book machine. Spare parts come in handy. It's got a single control, which is, it's actually two controls. It's a button and a knob right on the top of the device. And you can see it takes an NLS cartridge that goes in the front. The interesting part is what's inside. What's inside is another Raspberry Pi computer and a cellular modem. Okay, so this little box actually connects to the cellular network right now. And what we're doing is distributing these out to, at first, 25 of the NLS staff members to take home and try out at home. So what we're learning from that is, just in the DC area at least, what are some of the complexities of pushing books across the cellular network? How long does it take? What kind of errors do we get? Who can't connect at all? What percent of the people can't connect at all? We're actually using the Verizon network with this MVNE right now, but ultimately we'll want to use multiple wireless networks. Don't worry, you will not have to support this machine. It is just something that we're using for testing. Unless you're one of the libraries that's going to help us out with the pilot, then you might have to support it. But it's really great. It talks its status when you first plug it in. It tells you what it's doing as it goes through the boot up process. It tells you when it's connected to the internet. It tells you when it's connected to Bard. Even better, it tells you when you've got books waiting. Now, what that means is you've got books on your wish list. What this thing will do is go to your Bard account, and it will download the first three things on your wish list to its internal memory. When you stick a cartridge in there, it deletes what's on the cartridge and puts the next book in the queue onto your cartridge. And then it tells you it's doing that, and it tells you when it's done and to take the cartridge out. You pull the cartridge out, and you go and you stick it in your digital hawking book machine, and you read it. When you put the cartridge back in, it erases that book and gives you the next one. Okay? Even more interesting, we've given one of our librarians at work, it's Chris Corrigan, he's one of our reference librarians, who's also worked in the network, and who is moonlighting at the moment as the head of bibliographic control, but he's doing this job for us right now. He's acting as a reader advisor, so some of the staff members are pretending they don't know how to use Bard. They actually don't know how to use Bard, but some of them are playing this role, and they're actually calling Chris, and he's going through the steps of being a reader advisor and putting books onto their wish list, and then at home, a minute later, this thing actually downloads it, and if they stick a cartridge in, they'll get a book on the cartridge. So we're also learning sort of how it feels to be able to push a book, what some of the delays are, how you go about working with the patrons and things like that. So it's a really interesting little device. It was created by John Brown in our engineering section. It's called Mocha for two reasons. One is because the code inside is written in Java. But Mocha stands for mobile cartridge. Now, it's not mobile, and it's not a cartridge. I thought they should call it Project Latte, because it lays on the table. But okay. No, what's mobile is the mobile network. That's where that comes from. So really what this thing is it's a virtual mailman, right? It delivers one book at a time for you. Or if you have two cartridges, you can fill them both up. Delivers two books at a time. But again, the goal is there to test the network and to test a little bit of the reader advisor experience. So more pilots going on. Lots more to report back to you guys with the next time we see you. Zoom slideshow. Okay, what else? Gutenberg, I'm not going to cover too much. I think we've probably talked that one to death already. Gutenberg is making a lot of progress, and as Richard mentioned earlier, we've opened up an application programming interface on Gutenberg so that it can be talked to directly by the CIRC systems. So if you want to have a book duplicated, you can do that right from within. Right now, Web Reads, and later the other circulation systems. I don't know if you're aware, but we're having actually weekly conference calls with all the circulation system vendors who have been wonderfully cooperative, and we're working with them on how their systems are going to interact with all the new pieces at NLS. Okay, this is where things get a little bit more interesting. Let's talk about microservices. So I said earlier that we were going to blow up Bard, and I'm going to explain that comment right now. Let's take a system like Bard, and let's look at all of the things that a computer system like Bard has to do. Well, it's got to have a database to store all the information that it needs. It's got to present a user interface on a web page. Right? It's got to have a catalog so it knows about all the books that it's got. It's got to do authentication, because you need to be able to log into Bard, and it needs to know that you are who you say you are. That's authentication. It needs to do authorization, right? And that is giving you access to those materials to which you are permitted access. It handles messaging. It gives you help. It does reporting. It does logging. it's got an API so that other devices can talk to it. Should I keep going? It handles applications for service through Bard. It's got search, preferences, et cetera, wish list, history, download. It goes right off the bottom of the slide here. Bard does a lot, and all that stuff is unique to Bard. Okay? But let's go ahead and look at another system. Yeah? Okay. I'm taking Gutenberg here as an example, but really this could apply to PIMS or CRIMS or any of the other stuff that we do at NLS. It's also got a database. It's also got a user interface and a catalog and does authentication and authorization and messaging and help and reporting and logging and accounting, and it's got an API. You see what I'm getting at here? We've got a lot of repetition, and that's kind of silly. But this is how systems were built when they were built sort of monolithically, right? Each system that you had to do all these things. Well, things don't work that way anymore. So, of course, there's a lot of commonality here. Both systems need a database. Both systems need a catalog. Both systems need to do authentication and authorization. You see, I skipped user interface. That's something they both do, but they don't have that in common. All right, the user interface for Bard is obviously a separate thing than the user interface for Gutenberg. Okay, but you're seeing that there is quite a lot of repetition, quite a lot of redundancy in building various systems. So we are taking a different approach now, and we're going from this sort of long vertical list of things that our services have to do into this horizontal integration where we have individual machines that do each of these functions. Okay, so now, instead of having separate authentication, authorization, and accounting, or AAA servers for functions in Bard and in Gutenberg, we're going to have a AAA server. We're going to have one machine whose responsibility it is to do all of that stuff. And so if Bard needs AAA services, it can talk to the AAA server. And if Gutenberg needs AAA services, it can talk to the AAA server. So we have one central place where you can take care of all that. And same with logging, and the same with reporting, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so then the question becomes, isn't that really expensive? I mean, if you're going to have all these different servers doing all these different things, now suddenly you've got a big forest of hardware, et cetera, et cetera. And the answer, of course, is no, because again, that's not the direction we want to head. All this stuff is going to be done using what are called virtual machines. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. But the idea is that services that run in the cloud, and you didn't think we could get through a technical discussion without the word cloud, like seeping in there somewhere. They run on these, what's that?
Floating in there,
thank you. They run on serious hardware that virtualizes a bunch of other smaller computers. Okay, so what's really nice about this is it becomes very cost effective because that one giant computer that runs all of these smaller virtual ones can do a trade-off of which of these virtual machines gets computing power at different times. So if there's one server somewhere and it's got a dozen virtual machines and one of them is our logging server and that logging server isn't busy at that time, it can give more attention to something else that may be from another company entirely that's running on that same hardware. So that makes things very cost effective. And the fact that it's all in the cloud means that we can give you faster service because it can be positioned nearer to you physically. It means easy scalability because if our messaging server gets too busy, we could actually spin up a second messaging server. There's no actual change in hardware. We just replicate the first one. Now we got two. It's real nice. Everything becomes very elastic. Everything also becomes very reliable because the companies, these cloud service providers, they can make everything redundant. All right. So instead of the long outages that we have experienced because there is only one installation of something, it's very easy now to have multiple installations, even across multiple vendors. So we are actually going to have a cloud contract with, let's say, Google, and Google's cloud services will be running many of our processes. We're going to have a hot backup on, let's say, again, there's contracts to be let, but let's say Amazon is the other one. We can actually run the same software in both places, and we can switch at a moment's notice from one to the other. So we get cost effectiveness, we get scalability, we get reliability. It's really a big win all around. So this is the direction that we're heading. We're breaking our services, our systems, into little pieces. And it also sort of explains why you're not seeing a whole lot of changes. They're not very visible, but there is a ton of work that's going on at NLS to take care of all of this. Something else that we can do. We can even open these things up a little bit. Our authentication, authorization, and accounting server, our AAA server, is going to run a protocol called OAuth and OpenID. Now, OpenID you might be familiar with. This is what you get when you log into a website and it says, well, would you rather log in with your Google account or your Facebook account? And if you say yes, it takes you over to that service and you put in your credentials and suddenly you have access to the original service. Well, now we can offer that as well, okay? Because we're going to, our server is going to be an OpenID provider. Obviously, everything has to be done with security and privacy in mind. But folks like Bookshare who want to know, is this person eligible for NLS service, can now do this in an automated way. They can talk to our server and assuming everything is set up and everyone has permission, get the information that a new patron might be eligible for service. We have spoken to both Bookshare and Internet Archive, both of whom serve many of the same folks that we do. And in fact, we could even offer this to HathiTrust, whom you heard from this morning. So we can go beyond just building these things essentially for our use. We can, in fact, also open them up to you if you have a service at your library that would benefit from this. So if you do, let's talk. I guess what I really want to say is the whole system is sort of more than the sum of its parts. It reminds me of what happened in 2008 when everything was digital. I tell this story all the time. I'm going to tell it again. When I came to NLS in 2004 for my job interview, I was asking about, well, you know, they were telling me about the digital transition and how it should all be done by 2008. And I said to the folks who interviewed me, what happens in 2008? And they said, well, we all just go away. In fact, all three of the people who interviewed me did then just go away. But what the point I'm trying to make is that they saw the digital transition as the end of something, right? They saw, okay, we had cassettes and they're analog, and now we have cartridges and they're digital, okay? But as we all know, just the fact that we now had books in a digital format meant that we could start doing all kinds of cool new things, okay? So now we could distribute the books on a website, on Bard, and we could do a mobile app. And who knows what else we can do? We can, you know, run through the database of metadata that we've now got on all these books and glean all sorts of information. We could even, you know, a few years from now, run a machine learning algorithm to listen to all the books and figure out something more about the collection. Maybe the collection is biased, racially biased, right? We don't know. Nobody's ever done that kind of study before, but you could do it, right? You could listen to all the books because the books are digital, right? There's all kinds of possibilities that weren't there before. And then I think that's where we're going to be going to. We're going to take all these NLS systems and break them up into pieces, and people are going to come up with new and interesting ways of mixing and matching the parts to maybe enable us to offer services that we couldn't even conceive of before. That is about all I wanted to cover. I did want to just cover two more overarching concerns, and I mentioned them just briefly a minute ago, and those are security and privacy. We talked a lot about having machines in people's houses that are connected to the internet and have microphones in them so they can listen to your voice commands. There's a lot of people that are squeamish about that sort of thing, and rightly so. We've also talked about some other things that we can do internally with the software in those machines to sort of gauge how they're being used. It's very common, for example, right now, if you go to a website on one computer and your friend goes to that same website on their computer, you might see two different things. Okay? What's going on is called A-B testing, and people who run big websites will make tweaks to their user interfaces and present two different user interfaces to two different people to see which one people use better, which one they have fewer problems with or like more or get more use out of. Okay, and we were talking the other day when we were talking about our requirements. Why don't we do that sort of thing with our machine? We could even test new features in software by letting some people use it one way and some people use it another way. Because don't forget, that machine that we put out there is going to be completely upgradable in the field. So then we got to a discussion of, well, what information do we want to gather back? Okay, and this is where the whole privacy and security thing comes in, right? Would it be useful for us to know how far people have read into a book? Now, it would be very useful, right? We would know which books people were actually reading versus which ones they were downloading and then not reading, maybe abandoning after a short time, right? And while we certainly wouldn't let that affect selection, it may help out with other aspects of how the machine gets used or how things get pushed. One of the big ones is, do we stream it or do we download it, okay? If we know you're only going to read the first 5 minutes of a book, we're not going to let you download 120 megabytes. That's going to cost a lot of money. Okay, so we want to know what you read, but there are serious privacy concerns there, okay? Everything, you know, that we do in that field, we have to be very careful that we maintain users' privacy, that we are completely transparent about it, and that we let them opt out And so I want to sort of reassure everybody that we do have security and privacy in mind, and that those things overarch all of the other kind of experimentation that we want to be doing in developing the new talking book machine. How are we doing on time, since I don't know what time we...
5 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I'll just stop talking then, because we want to leave some time for questions. Sorry about that. Please do wait for the mic if you have a question. I've been asked to remind you. Hello, Scott.
Hi, Neil. How are you? If the pedometer is out...
Yeah.
How about Bluetooth?
Yes, I think that Bluetooth is very likely. The question is which direction. We don't want this device to be used as a very nice Bluetooth speaker for people who want to listen to music, for example. Mm-hmm. We do want you to be able to have it communicate with other devices. We would probably use Bluetooth for any kind of remote control, for example. We would certainly want you to be able to use Bluetooth headphones. Yeah. With materials that are on the machine itself. Whether it receives from Bluetooth, one thing we talked about was letting Bard Mobile actually serve as a remote control for the device. Okay, so that if you have a phone in your hand, you can actually start and stop a book on the tabletop on the machine. And that would be a Bluetooth function as well, quite probably. But we don't want to leave it completely open.
Thank you.
Well.
Sue Green from Michigan.
Hey, Sue.
Do you envision these equipment pieces being distributed from the libraries or from like a regional?
Which one are you referring to? The
new
talking book machine or the
yep.
e-reader? Actually, pretty much all of them. Yes, we do envision the distribution model being the same, and for the most part, the maintenance model as well. I mean, we have lots of requirements, for example, in that Braille e-reader RFI that we put out that have to do with maintenance. We want as much modularity as possible. We want as many field replaceable parts as possible. So, yeah, we don't expect that model will change.
Shelley Rosine. So I will mention this since Sue Green would not. Maybe the possibility of a GPS locator on the new machine for people that lose their machine?
Well, okay. GPS didn't come up. We did actually have a lot of discussion about what to do when people misplace their machine. Judy Dixon, our consumer relations officer, she says that, you know, 5 times a day she will find her iPhone by pinging it from her Apple Watch.
That's real nice.
The place where we get rescued with that is if we do have the voice interface. We can have a where are you function.
Okay.
Right, so you can scream out to the machine, where are you, and have it say, I'm over here, where you left me, because
okay.
I'm always where you left me. I didn't get up and walk. So, but that's one way to do that. Now, in terms of a machine that's left on a bus, where GPS would come in handy, probably not, but you never know. Anything else? Okay, lots of stuff, right? All right, well, thanks for listening, everybody, and I'll see you tomorrow in the hands-on session at 3:15.